For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening and welcome, everyone.
Good evening.
I'm very happy tonight to have giving our talk Hogetsu, who was our former Tenzo and currently our teacher of sewing for Buddha's robes. So thank you very much, Hogetsu.
Thank you, Tygon. Good evening, Bodhisattvas.
Good evening.
Be at ease, please. I think I've used this thing before. It's big. But my glasses are broken, so it's good that it's closer to my eyes so I can actually maybe see what I have down here. Not that it matters. I just want to really express my appreciation for all of us practicing together, you know, in this kind of cool autumn Monday evening. Drag yourselves to the dragon and listen to something, some words. I'd like to, you know, maybe share with you, practice with you some things that I have not fully realized. So maybe we'll realize them together, or realize them a little bit further. I think the question that's been sort of rolling around in my mind stream has been sort of how does a bodhisattva behave? How does our practice inform how we handle the situations of our lives? Although I have heard that Zen is good for nothing, I think I'd like to hope that it's good for something. The phenomenal world that we exist in and worlds that we maybe don't know. So I'd like to tell you a little story. It's a recent experience that has really stuck with me. And some of you may have heard versions of this story. And I've come to think of it sort of as a teaching story. You know, these old sort of teaching stories, sometimes called koans, that often involve old geezers shouting at each other or hanging out together, spouting something profound and having competition to be more profound than the others somehow. But really encouraging each other to bring out the best and deepest parts of their practice and share that with the world. But I think these kind of stories, you know, all of our life is a story. Everything, we make it all up. And so I thought, well, we make it up. We make our own koans, our own teaching stories up every day. So here's one that came to me from a very dear friend. I asked her permission. So I made up a little koan. Here it is. My Dharma sister was knocked off her bicycle on the Chicago lakefront path. Many people walked by. Some spoke to her. Some did not notice. Others thought they were too busy. Others thought someone else would respond. No one helped her. So I was touched by this experience that my friend told. You know, some fast-moving cyclists didn't like her slow movement and nudged her a bit, and she fell down and hurt herself. And the people on the bikes, there are many people on bikes and running and walking and, you know, all the fun things we do on the lake path. guys on the bike, one of them got off, and the guy who hit her and said, "Oh, are you okay?" And she's like, "I think so." You know, if any of you have ever fallen off of a bicycle and hit the concrete, your first responses are usually a bit dizzy. So, fine. And he's like, "Oh, I'm so relieved. I didn't want to, you know, have to stop to deal with you," essentially. And off they went. And my friend was pretty dazed, you know. And she kind of, you know, ambled over to a park bench and kind of sat down with her slightly crumpled vehicle. And she said the most comforting person was an old guy who kind of looked a little maybe homeless-like and smelling of alcohol, who just kind of sat with her. And I thought, this is somebody who knows what it's like to be hurt. And I thought, you know, what would I do in that situation? I'm sure I've been in one where I might have seen something go on. And I'm not saying that there's like a right or wrong way, but I guess what I want to encourage all of you is to take these kind of situations in your life and inhale them, you know, and run them through your Dharma equipment. You know, you're all building up some kind of Dharma body, Dharma factory when you're sitting zazen. Something's happening. So, you know, run it through that process. Because most pictures of bodhisattvas, I don't have my glasses on, so I can't quite see what's going on. But, you know, it's great. So, but usually, like, that one's probably in some kind of leaf boat. Yeah, let me see if these will help. I do astigmatism and everything else. Wow, this is even more interesting. I can see less.
You don't have to.
But thank you for offering them. How do they look? You know, I need a new pair of glasses.
I can't see.
They're kind of nice. Yeah. It's a hard thing when you go to buy glasses. You can't see when you put them on. Anyway, but most bodhisattvas, you know, beings dedicated to helping others, they're actually in some kind of active position. Like, their knees are usually kind of up, like they're kind of ready to spring off of their lotus seats to kind of meet the world with compassion and caring. And that doesn't mean controlling, like, let me be a good Samaritan and help you. It's a natural response. You know, there's one up there, I don't know, is that Manjushri?
Yeah.
Sitting on a lion? Yeah. And Samantabhadra rides an elephant. That's my favorite. I wish I could ride an elephant. But, you know, there's some dragon rolling around. I don't know. There's activity. You know, we tend to think of the Shakyamuni Buddha just like hanging out. And this is good. This is the least dangerous position we can probably occupy, is sitting quiet, you know, and you probably need extra restraint. If you're a priest, you probably have to, like, be extra sort of bad because you've got all these clothes that kind of, like a burrito, kind of folds you up, or a straitjacket. But, you know, there's something that keeps us, so we can be a little still, so we might be able to notice that somebody fell off their bicycle and might need help, and how to be skillful in that process. You know, we all have stories. I can just give you some stories. More story, a personal one. I remember going to a Zen monastic experience where people gather together and live together and sit together day in and day out. And we have service, which is a little more, in these situations, probably a little more elaborate than what we just did. Like, you know, if you thought the Genjo Koan was long, you know, just go to a Zen Center service. So you take your zabutons after zazen off of your cushion and put them on the floor. So there's like a sitting platform, and you take them off and you put them on the floor so you can do bowing and stuff like that on the floor. And I remember going, I'm going to get right up in the front so I can watch the tanto and see how that person does service. because I want to do service. I love Buddha. I love service. I want to do it wholeheartedly. But I want to, like, watch the best person in the Zendo perform their act, right? So, like, I was off my cushion and, you know, my zabuton in hand and, like, racing to the front. Of course, all kind of slowly, right? You know, like, nobody's really running around a Zendo. But I could feel, you know, like, there was someone sitting next to me. There was a relatively new priest. And it took her a while to figure out how to get her robes put her robes on and get it off the zabuton and stuff. And I wasn't encumbered by an acacia, so I could just sit my rapaksu on and go to the front of the class. And then it occurred to me that I actually was having this energy of pushing people out of the way to get things the way I wanted them. And you know, on one hand, very wholesome thing, right? Wanting to do the form correctly and get the best seat in the house to watch that. And so actually what I ended up doing was, when I started to realize this, you know, it was very kind of painful. You know, I have to sit the rest of the Zazen period realizing, like, oh, I could feel this energy in my body that's aggressive, trying to control a situation and not even thinking about how it felt for the people next to me or the people around me. And I'm very grateful for those experiences because it showed me where my practice had an edge, not just the sharp edge to it, but where my wish to benefit beings was rubbing up against something else called delusion, confusion, aversion, you know, the usual suspects. And that edge is kind of endless. I think actually, if you're sitting Zazen, that they're sitting on that edge of where your practice fails to realize your best intentions, to even think that those intentions are yours, and to tolerate the limited nature of human beings, and to tolerate the limitless nature of human beings. So, we have these little compartments of practice, you know, maybe like we have a practice place at home and we have a practice place in the Zendo, which are kind of safe. I always call them playpens, you know. They're little places where we're kind of contained. But the effort I think that we make, or that I encourage us, everyone, all of us to think about, is how do we go beyond that and open those pockets up until they are more and more seamless. Until they, it's like the Big Bang, you know, until they expand out into the universe to all beings without exception. You know, Taigen said something to me once which I've never forgotten. Of all the things you've said to me, I've probably forgotten quite a few. But he would ask me to, after Zazen, to count how many people were in the Zendo. And one time, you know, and so he was in California at the time, and I'd say, you know, Hogetsu or Lori reporting, you know, 17 people. And he said, have you counted all the beings not on the cushions? And I said, oops, I forgot a few. And so that always is, it's very nice to know. I'm always forgetting a being. And I have to live with that. You know, and finding this edge is sort of poignant or a little, you know, heart-rendering as it can be. That edge is a refuge. It is. I believe that that's what our practice is. It's this refuge of like, oh, thank you, Buddha, for cluing me in to where I was missing something. Another friend of mine. Here's a story most of us can maybe relate to a little bit. Driving. A friend of mine loves to drive. loves to race cars. He's also an old-time Zen practitioner. And he said early in his life, you know, even during the first 20 or so years of his Zen practice, he would, when he was driving by himself, he would, like, a couple times ran people off the road because he was impatient, you know, they got in his way. He goes, he'd often kind of, like, you know, ride right behind their bumper. And he sort of began to practice and notice that. And then he started to write practice instructions. He ended up being the person writing practice instructions for people who drove people around at a Zen center. So he transformed his practice in some way. And one of his instructions was, drive in such a way so that the least comfortable person is comfortable with you driving. And I thought, that's maybe how we want to drive our lives, you know? So that the least comfortable person ends up feeling okay, feeling like you care in some way. And this without exception. And so even, I think, like on that bike path, it's easy to kind of be like, well, guys who bumped my friend off, they're the bad dudes and she's the good one or something, or, you know. Those are all sort of these divisions. But how do we include all those kind of people? The people who are driving on our bumpers, the people, the parts of ourselves that are, you know, pushing people out of the way, or hiding. That could be another thing. Hiding is another thing that could happen. How do we work with these parts of our everyday experience? And each one of us has that sort of possibility, you know, and finding that, you know, it is not an edge, the edges of our practice, it's not an edge of shame. We might regret it, but I think regret and shame are two different things. You know, there's sort of a wholesome shame that I would call regret, like, I'm sorry I did that, and I don't want to do it again. And still maybe one does these things again. But shame is a little bit different. That, to me, is more in the realm of what I would call negative self-clinging. You know, I'm bad. Fully bad. That's maybe a little extra. That's like being, I'm great, this person in the world. It's a flip side. So, what's the time situation, Taigen-san?
8:30, so we have 10 minutes. 10
okay.
Minutes before
meltdown or?
Oh, whatever.
Okay. So I thought maybe I'll just, there's so many things to say, but I'll leave you with another old teaching story, and then I kind of would like to hear your own responses and experiences along this edgy path of something that we call Buddhism right now in Chicago in 2012. There's another old teaching story, and it says, it's from the Book of Serenity, which all you scholars can go look up, case 67. But I think what matters is this. This is the whole case. The Flower Ornament Sutra says, I can now see that all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, but because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. This is someone falling off a bicycle and nobody helping. And someone calling a friend afterwards and said, I need help, and the friend helped. I can now see that all, it might be heresy, but I'll just say, all beings, sentient, non-sentient, rocks, trees, walls, rivers, bicycles, airplanes, blimps, everywhere, fully possess the wisdom and virtue of people who are on the path of going beyond Buddha. But because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. So my wish is that all of you will continue to realize it more and more fully. And thank you for listening to this.
Thank you.
I'd love to listen to you. Jeremy, sorry.
Thank you for the talk.
You're welcome.
Also, thank you for changing Vinjir Khan. We're going to do that for the Tushan Pass. It's really cool. That's the longest thing we've ever But, I'm a teacher. I teach teenagers. And it's fast-paced business being a teacher. And I've been noticing that I don't keep all beings in mind when I'm teaching. Everything's so fast. I have to, there's so many different personalities, there's so many different people, so many different bodies coming through the door, that I feel like I forget all beings. And I feel like if I were to slow down and try to actually address them, that I would kind of just like lose the flow. And I almost feel like forgetting all beings is almost more difficult than the opposite. I don't know if that's true. I actually don't even know what would happen if I were to slow down and try it.
Try that first.
Yeah.
And then forget yourself. So study that. Study how you forget. Study what happens if you slow down. Ask for feedback from the beings. Teenagers might get a little freaked out if you slow down and actually look at them.
They do.
Yeah. So check that out. Is that freaking you out? You know. But this is great. That edge is going to last for your whole career probably. So. You're welcome. I don't know your name. I know
you,
Casey. Thank you.
Thank you for the talk. It was nice to see you on the street the other day.
Yeah, I couldn't see very well, so like I couldn't recognize you until after you left. I saw the face. I'm like, I know that person from somewhere.
No worries. I was in a hurry. I think that there's like an ultimate ending to that story too, with the no one stopped to help her. No one stopped, but people helped her. Just because you don't actively help someone doesn't mean you don't teach them anything. And I think there's a lot to be said for that concept that if you haven't been there, then you're not going to understand. And that, not necessarily with your friend, but if you're someone and something happens to you and no one stops and helps, you're going to remember that you're wrong. What is it like to be? And that lesson transitions into other encounters.
Yes, actually, the whole world was helping her. And still, how do we respond? It's a good point. That's a deep and sort of subtle question, but maybe you'll write another story yourself. So that's a nice alternate ending. You know, all these koans, these teaching stories, like have all these people who wrote their commentaries. Like, no, I could better that one. But actually, it's good. That's how you spur us on. So I thank you for your comment. I think it's really, this is that part of like seeing all beings as Buddha, right? So even those Buddhas who were walking by, were walking by. And helped her in some way.
Maybe not the best way.
Yeah. if they would have stopped and asked and said, is it okay if I just walk by and leave you laying here, please? She might have laughed so crazy. Yeah, sure. You know, have a concussion anyway. Thank you. And then...
So I can't resist. In the spirit of koans, I have a bike koan.
Oh, great.
So I was riding my bike to work one morning, and riding by a parked car, and the person opens their door, and the door hits me and knocks me on the pavement. Unfortunately, there were no cars behind me, and the person gets out of his car, and he looks down at me, and he says, you should watch where you're going. And I was stunned and couldn't quite react. And but of course I could watch myself, even though I couldn't get up, wanting to take my bike and hit him on the head with it. And I didn't do this, and he, whatever, he sort of kind of checked to make sure I was okay. He told me it was good I was wearing a helmet, which I appreciated. But then it's kind of stuck with me, watching where I'm going. And of course, on my bike, it made me very aware. When you ride in traffic, you sometimes have to occupy space and make drivers know that you're occupying space. And it made me aware of ways of doing that that are aggressive and ways of doing that that are useful. And of course, he's right. We have to watch where we're going.
Right. That's another capping verse. This is great. We should have the Ancient Dragon koan collection. Oh, I mean, you know, this is an interesting point. Did you want to say something?
Oh, I had another bicycle story.
Oh.
About half a dozen years ago, there was a defect in pavement or actually in force reserve, and I fell down and I was dazed. I don't know if I was wearing a helmet or not, but I was dazed, I was bleeding a little bit, and it turned out I actually cracked my humerus. So I was, you know, I was dazed and bleeding a little bit, but you know, I wasn't unconscious. And a lot of people went by, and one guy stopped, and then he gave me a lift back to my car. And so I think my inclination would always be to stop for somebody who's in that kind of situation, if they were a bicyclist. No, just kidding.
Yeah. Other people, cars.
Right, but it's just, you know, it's really a deep appreciation for somebody who actually takes the time to do that and tune into the situation as opposed to their pre-programmed activity that they're doing, you know, so it's, and it certainly isn't everybody, so.
More?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Hi.
Another bicycle. But it was, it's what struck me when you shared the story, was my sense of judgment towards the person that didn't stop. It was this immediate response. And then I was like, where did this come from? And I started to think back about 4 years ago after a book club right on Broadway near Foster. I watched a guy ride his bike into a telephone pole. Clearly there was something wrong. He fell over. I immediately rushed over to him and, you know, are you okay? And he started to wave. And so I talked to him, get somebody to call 911. They come. And then I was struck, that same sense of judgment, by the ambulance folk. He's got alcohol in his breath.
Mm-hmm.
There's something, you know, and it was this immediate step back, but I was just reminded again of that sense of, that stance of both wanting to be the helper and also the one that's staying in judge at the same time.
Well, I you know, the thing that struck me a little bit, and, you know, Ben, when you mentioned, like, you know, after you were dazed, you wanted to take the bicycle and, like, hit the person, right? We have a physiology as humans. And that also entails emotional responses. And I think that when we feel threatened, anger is in mammals, actually. Someday maybe I'll talk about this. But mammals have, all mammals have, like, six, I think, basic emotional systems, right? So, you know, I think fear if you follow this down, our judgment is rooted in fear often. Like, I want to find the right way because this is so painful to see somebody hurt. Mm-hmm. And I want to get rid of all that suffering. You know, so it almost comes from this very primal place a lot of times. You know, I think, you know, we don't talk in Zen that much about emotions. but I think they're really important aspects of our Buddhist practice, that to watch how our emotional systems work in our bodies. You know, and those emotions can be, you know, the basic kind of, you know, anger, fear. You know, we talk about greed, hate, and delusion, but I think fear is a real motivator for a lot of suffering. You know, and getting to the sadness underneath, that like it's hard to bear suffering and see someone hit a pole or be unkind. So thank you for bringing up judgment.
Mm-hmm. Just a small thing about the story. I find it quite interesting, people's responses to the story, actually, because there's a sort of assumption running through the responses that the bikers who pass the Borough of Balogo, I guess, were presumably indifferent. But then there could be many other explanations, you know, also. I mean, they may not have realized how hurt she was. You know, and had she asked for help, of course, had she been in a state where she couldn't have asked for help, had she been unfortunately hurt worse, you know, it's probably likely that a lot of people would have stopped by. And I've seen that happen a lot with both the bikers and other people badly hurt. There's this reaction where we want to come in and help, you know. And it reminds me, too, of a very famous situation. I think it was in the 50s. I only remember Strands' story. Some of you may remember as well. It was called the Kitty Genovese.
Oh, yes.
Case, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I believe hundreds of people, or many dozens of people, had actually seen these buildings, this poor woman being attacked, and the voices were very loud, and went on for a very long time. And she unfortunately was killed. And, you know, of course, there would have been time for the police to have been called. And so for years after that, there was this assumption in articles and major papers about how humans have sort of become more indifferent, and perhaps it was a result of our atomized existence, and we've become more, you know, less caring in our industrial society, and so on. And later, in experiments that they conducted after that, they found that when people who are in a similar situation or are hurt or need help actually directly ask, you know, someone for help, The response rate goes up from like 0 to almost 100. But this has a lot to do, I believe, with the way we've been, you know, the way we evolved in a group, and usually responsibilities have been shared, usually. Mm-hmm. And usually the sound of a crying baby is associated with a mother somewhere who attends to the child in most cases. But clearly this is a sort of like a bias, if you like, the humans have, that, which was very costly for her and of course for your friend who fell over. And it seems to me that if we become aware of these sort of bias, that would at least allow us to be able to respond more frequently to people who are hurt and really need your help with their house, you know.
Yeah, people who are traumatized, who are attacked or assaulted, usually have the first response is a freezing response. So people are like, why didn't you fight back or yell for help or something? But actually, physiologically, the body usually, the very first response is freezing. Some people can recover more quickly. But my friend said, she goes, I was so dazed, I didn't even think to ask anybody, and kind of, you know. And there's also the situation that, if speaking of psychology, this is a great one. The example of mindlessness, where if you ask somebody for just about any request out of the blue, people will acquiesce to it. So, you know, the psychologist, you know, I'm a psychologist, so they did these experiments. They're like, they'd have people randomly cut in line when they had copying machines at the university and just say, can I copy, you know, and they wouldn't even say, I'm in a hurry. And like some huge percentage of people would say yes. So sometimes we may be saying yes to things that we might not want to be saying yes to, but, you know, your point is well taken that, you know, asking is a good thing. And a lot of times people are, you know, too, like, kind of smug or prideful to ask for help. You know, and that's where I think Buddhist Sangha is really wonderful. We're all actually helping each other. And we realize this in a very intimate way. Yes, Don.
But sometimes I wonder if or in my experience, wondering if I really need help. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do I really need help? Do I really need help right now? Like, I'm sitting here getting ready, thinking I'm having a heart attack, I've got my baby, but do I really need help? Do I need to ask for help? You know, like, or something, you know, like that, you know, and so I don't know if I need to ask for help, or, but nobody's gonna know either, you
unless
know, so unless I say something, but I don't know, you know, so I mean, if I were really going to be having a heart attack, it would really be a bad situation.
How would you know?
I wouldn't.
That's right.
I mean, I guess I wouldn't. It just happened. I'd be laying there, and hopefully somebody would help me.
But there is this part of not knowing, and that we exist in this world where we don't really know. You know, we don't know, and we're negotiating. You know, we don't know what the best response really was in this bike situations. You know, we know what we would have liked to have preferred to have. You know, I always like to get my own way and have the most comfortable outcome. You know, but it's negotiation. I think, you know, if you think you're having a heart attack, I think it might be a good idea just to check in with somebody about that. That would be, you know, kind of my basic thing. I mean, I think there was quite a Zen teacher who actually started to have, like, you know, myocardial infarction during Dokusan.
Yeah, that was my teacher.
Yeah. He told me the story. So, I mean, but he was, like, aware of what was going on. He's like, you know, I think I'm having a heart attack.
I think he was having Dokusan with Fu, and he said, oh, my heart. And she felt like he was being very moving, and he was actually having a... Anyway, they worked it out, and I took him to the hospital, and he was okay. So, happy ending.
Yeah, and the nice thing about Zendo is, you know, like this, is if something's happening to somebody, it's sort of the job of the Eno, and that's why somebody faces forward, actually, in the Zendo, so that we can, if somebody falls off their cushion or something, somebody will take care of it.